Hello and welcome to The Detail. I'm Katie Melua.
And I'm Polly Scattergood.
This week we are speaking to someone who gives interviews very rarely, who worked for over 20 years at the pioneering BBC's Radiophonic Workshop, the legendary Emmy Award nominated musician and composer Elizabeth Parker. Elizabeth was in fact the last composer to leave when it closed in 1996. She started her career as a studio manager and went on to compose over 1,400 works for film and TV in her career. She was actually the first composer to receive a master's degree in electronic music at the University of East Anglia, and her catalogue includes everything from David Attenborough's The Living Planet to Doctor Who's Time Lash.
Welcome to The Detail. If you enjoy listening to this podcast, it's been lovingly made by me and Katie. The editing, however, has been done by me, Polly Scattergood, in my studio at home. So if you're a fan of this podcast and you'd like to hear more, receive additional content and the odd special treat sent directly from me to you, please head on over to my Patreon page to show your support. The address is patreon.com/Polly Scattergood. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show. For those of you who haven't heard of the Radiophonic Workshop, it really was a pioneering institution in the field of electronic music, where many of the TV productions that the BBC were creating throughout the 20th century, they creating the sound effects for, they were all made in the Radiophonic Workshop. Liz, you started in 1978 and you left in 1996, so you were one of the few composers who went all the way from reel to reel, right through to computers. So, you essentially witnessed the birth of electronic music. Can you tell us a little bit about what a typical day was like for you?
Well, I don't think there was a typical day ever. Obviously, at the beginning, in 77, we were working reel to reel with tape loops round, columns and very, very clunky machinery and one synthesizer. So even doing a 5-second jingle would take you 1 or 2 days. And then by the end, you'd come in and you'd be on a computer and, a bit of equipment and everything. But the same thing that would have taken you 2 days to do took you maybe half an hour, with sampling and everything. I mean, it's so ridiculous when you think about it. To be honest, I never really got used to the fact that everything got more and more small and all into the computer. To be honest, I didn't really like that at the end. But I've detoured from your question, but there wasn't a typical day. But it tended to start with a cup of coffee in the canteen and then you'd start your work. And there was a lot of thought process went on at night, when I was just sort of thinking in the evening about what I was going to do the next day.
What was that first synthesizer? You mentioned that there was one synthesizer. Do you remember what it was, or is it all a bit of a blur?
It's a bit of a blur. No, I started off, the very first thing I did, as you mentioned, was Stones of Blood, Doctor Who, which I did as a holiday relief. And I did that using my own sounds and a VCR3, which I know you know, Polly, because you use it, and also a Synthi 100, which I'd also had use of when I was at UEA, University of East Anglia. So it was kind of familiar to me. But then I also started what I used for years afterwards, which was using my voice loads and loads, so making... so the Stones of Blood were these stones that sort of breathed and breathed blood, and they were horrible. They moved, they clunked around. And so a lot of the sounds I made at first were based on my slowed down and things like that. There was a Yamaha. The very first synthesizer I used was the monophonic Yamaha something or other, just a tiny little synth. Sounded just, unfortunately, I used it for The Living Planet for the signature tune, which had to be done way before any of the other music in 1981. I used that for the signature tune, and I always wished afterwards that I'd finished it and hadn't used that particular little tinny trumpet sound, because actually now I hate it. But that's by the by. It was of its time.
That's just remarkable. You know what I'm curious about, Elizabeth? You must have had... so many options at your fingertips, because all this equipment was, I think, capable of so much. But because the work was done for these TV productions that the BBC were working on, it kind of makes sense to me that there were these deadlines, you know, pretty hard deadlines where, you know, you had to, I guess, turn things around quite quickly. So I'm just curious about the thought process a little bit more. You know, you mentioned there was a lot of thinking going on in the evenings. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Yes. I mean, one was much more limited at the beginning. And also the time frames weren't anything like as small as they became in the 80s and the 90s. And in the 80s and 90s, you had sequences that would knock out, you know, a bass rhythm or a percussion track or whatever. And that was obviously when things started to generally become much more sounding the same. And so one's effort was always in trying not to sound the same. And I'm just thinking that I'll tell you a particular example, which was Points of View, which I did in 1988. I can't remember, 1988. But it was a 10-second signature tune for Points of View. Everybody was going to watch it. It had to be accessible. It had to be this. It had to be that. And it was really, really hard to do. And I got everything done apart from the first opening, you know, just the opening couple of notes. And that I could not crack. It didn't work. It didn't work. And one morning I came in at 6:30 and sat down and managed to actually suddenly, you know, do this thing. So what I'm saying is sometimes things came very easily and sometimes they didn't because you had all these briefs. It's quite different to being, as you two are, beautiful composers, you know, who can sort of think about what you want to say and what you want to do. This was, when I was working for a job, it was very much music to demand, under demand. So I had a list of criteria. And then it was up to me how I interpreted that. So it was all about interpretation. And my interpretation wasn't always the same as what the director wanted, which was a jolly old nuisance. So sometimes I just had to start again, particularly when we started working, when I started working for America. And of course, the American viewpoint on music often tended to be very, very different to, say, the British one. They wanted much more music all the time underneath everything. Whereas when I started, I was crafting the music around the dialogue and, you know, things have got very different now. Everyone just wants library music now, I think. I'm quite glad I'm not doing that. On the other hand, library music gives you a chance to express yourself and do the things you want. So I spent a lot of time experimenting and then maybe using some of those experiments in my work where I could get it in. A lot of time recording sounds and recording nice little riffs and things like that and sort of storing them up to use in an appropriate time. Sorry, I've probably totally wandered off this brief, but never mind.
No, that's fascinating. It's absolutely fascinating. You know what? It's interesting, this idea of kind of, you know, working whether for the briefs or for, you know, for your own kind of creativity. We watched an interview about some of your fellow composers at the workshop. And not to generalise, but I did find some of the male composers, they would describe the work there as very brutal and almost freakish because of the alien nature of the sounds at the time. You know, and I think for our listeners, you know, some of these sounds had never been heard before, which was why it was so pioneering, you know, with those early synthesizers. But then I watched an interview where that you gave, Elizabeth, and you have this beautiful description of trying to create the sound of a seahorse and the beauty of these creatures. And you actually used two hair combs to create their sound effect. And in this interview, you spoke with such delicate elegance. It made us realise that although you were working to very strict briefs, you clearly put your soul very much into it. So my question is, what piece of work would you say you're the most proud of?
Well, Katie, it has to be The Living Planet, because it was 13 episodes, entirely done on my own. I mean, I'm not sure it would ever happen now. You know, I had 12 one-hour episodes, and I was able to try and make the music come out of nature much more than it had done before. The first Life on Earth had been orchestral, very big orchestral, and nobody quite believed that synthesizers would be able to create music. And I think what I managed to do quite often was really make the music live. The trouble with synthesizers music is exactly what you said. It can be brutal and it can be very, just regular and not used properly. And there's no hiatus, there's no breath. And you know, music has to live. Music has to have a life, a beautiful life. You know, it doesn't all have to be beautiful, but when it is beautiful, it needs to live and it needs to breathe. And you're absolutely right. I probably am a very naturally emotional musician. And what I was working with were things that weren't particularly emotional. What I was trying to do, exactly that, trying to make it emotional and trying to create beautiful sounds out of what wasn't necessarily obviously very beautiful.
Did you give yourself any sort of rules in terms of, we were watching one interview where somebody was talking about how everything that was alive, he tried to use an organic sound for.
You're absolutely right. Gosh, you've really both done your research. This is frightening. No, absolutely. The idea for Living Planet was that it came from. So in Tropical Forest, I actually, you've probably seen this, I blew across a tomato ketchup bottle and I made this sort of sound that just was very evocative and very soft. And then I tried to use white noise shaped into waves and things so that the waves came out, the white noise and the music came out of the waves. I really did try and pick up on the atmosphere of much more than an orchestra. I felt the orchestral music in Life on Earth was far too heavy. I felt it, you know, I just never wanted to write orchestral music for natural history programs. And an awful lot of my cues for The Living Planet were exactly that, of organic. And fortunately, I'd just been provided with the PPG and the wave term, which I think there was only the Pet Shop Boys had one and maybe somebody in Germany. And I met the German chap once and I said to him, you know, do you have a problem with this that every now and then it just crashes and you lose everything? And he said, oh, yes, funnily enough, I do. Because it was the most infuriating machine. But without the wave term, I don't think I could have done Living Planet because that was my sampler. And when samplers were really quite new, and I was in very many ways, I was very lucky to be able to use that.
Before we move on, Elizabeth, I'd say I'm, as opposed to Polly, I'm probably more in the kind of acoustic space. So please forgive me, but I'd like to know a bit more about the wave sampler you were just talking about. Could you just, for people like me who are a little, inexperienced in terms of some of these samplers, how would you describe it to someone who's just discovered it for the first time?
It's a magic box. It was a square box, about 12 inches by 12 inches. And what you could do was put a sound in. So you would put in a dog bark, woof, woof. And then you could spread it across the keyboard. So it would go, woof, 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 woof. So, or you could put in, anything really. And then once it was recorded digitally, you could then play around with it. So you could take the top off, you could take the bottom off, you could play it on any note of the keyboard because it was linked up to a keyboard. I don't know if I'm describing it very well.
Yes, no, that does make perfect sense. So, and so suddenly you have a keyboard of the dog sound, for example.
Exactly. And you would have, say, so the tomato ketchup bottle that I'd blown across, up the top it would sound like a pan pipe, and at the bottom, and then at the bottom, it would go, you know, it would be like a beautiful alto bass flute, sort of longer. Well, you're quite right. I mean, the possibilities are enormous, but I always had in my mind a vague or sometimes quite distinct idea of where I wanted to be with the music. Uh-huh. So I always knew that I was searching, say, for a particular sound. And it might take me ages and ages because, as you know, with synthesizers, they just expanded and expanded. Mm. And so you had all these wonderful sounds. I probably had four or five other synthesizers. Please don't ask me what they were because I absolutely can't remember. but they were sitting around. And then I had this sampler. And, I always in my mind had an idea, a shape. Actually, it would be a shape and a colour of the piece that I was trying to create. So it's colour. very much. I'm thinking about it. You know, it would have a mood, a shape, a colour, a mood. And that's your starting point. And then you go into your orchestra. I hate to call it orchestra because that's quite a classical term, but it was your orchestra of amazing sounds, say 30% of which I'd created myself. And then you start to pick them off and then you start to mix them and merge them and they become wonderful, happy accidents. Uh-huh. And, you know, the piece emerges, and sometimes it emerges really quickly, and other times, you know, it's a bit of trial and error. Of course, I was really, really also interested in a lot of electronic stuff. And funnily enough, I think Trunk Records are going to bring out a CD which has a lot of my offcuts where I didn't use them for anything, but they were just where I was just experimenting. So I was experimenting with sounds and playing around with them. And I've always been interested in sound, mm-hmm. Right back from sort of hearing this'll date me, milk bottles clanking, you know, when the milkman came round and clanked his milk bottles and you thought, oh gosh, that's an interesting sound, you know, and you put them. So I've always been interested in hearing sound and listening to it. And the combination of that sound with maybe a classical sound, you know, a classical background, I think that's probably, you know, what I've been really interested in.
When the structure of the radiophonic workshop finished for you and those composers who were working under those kind of daily deadlines and the commissions, I mean, you were suddenly sort of left to find your way in the world of freelance. How did that transition work for you? And what did it do to your creative spirit? You know, did you feel a sense of total freedom, or was it scary?
Interesting.
What was it like?
Interesting question. What we did, locked up the studio. I'd actually was able to buy at vast expense a lot of my studio, and that was transferred over to Long Ditton, where we'd moved to. But initially, I locked the door of the studio. I said to the engineer, "Shall I give you the key?" And he said, "That'll be appropriate." So I gave him the key. I've never forgotten that. And I was in floods of tears, actually. I was in floods of tears. Yeah. And my husband was waiting for me, and we drove down to Cornwall with a van of equipment behind us, and we set up a very temporary studio. So I worked for a few years from Cornwall, which was an absolute nightmare and certainly stultified my creativity. I had quite a few commissions very soon afterwards. I did The Human Body and various things. Actually, my husband got a few from ITV, and, you know, I was really, really busy. But it was different. But it gave me more time to experiment, funnily enough. It did give me more time. But in the end, I actually got quite fed up. And gradually, by 2012, I thought, no, I don't want to do it anymore. I'll tell you what I really hated by the end. Gradually, my studio got smaller and smaller until it was all in this blessed big computer, you know, so all the mixing things were in the computer, everything. And I hated it. I really hated it.
Really?
It just didn't feel like music. It just didn't feel, you know, it didn't feel like me.
Yeah.
So that's why in the end I gave up. But actually the freelance time was pretty good. I certainly expanded my work quite a bit. Because I could then work for ITV and Channel 4 and America a bit more and things like that. So,
but in a way, I think that can be quite tricky, can't it, when actually you have a lot of different clients. Am I right in thinking that when you were at the BBC that, you know, the BBC was your client, and even though there was lots of different productions, perhaps there was some kind of management of your workflow? Am I right in saying that? Or not really?
Well, management of my workflow would have been wonderful, Katie. No, nobody really. I mean, we had the head of the radiophonic workshop, but I mean, nobody interfered. You could work from home. You could. I tended to have at the workshop, I probably had six or seven different projects on the go. But that didn't change once I left the BBC. I still had 6 or 7. And you really do have to manage mentally your work, because you might be doing something very poppy one day and then something else, and then somebody rings up and they need something done really quickly. One always had six or so projects on, whether at the workshop or... And I really... Well, once you're a freelance, you don't want to turn stuff down, do you?
I mean, you are mentioning this. I read in an interview that you were renowned for turning briefs around really quickly, you know, and I can understand if you have six on the go at the same time, you know, and also that flexibility was a big part of your skill set. How do you think you would advise, young composers to develop that? Is it just through practice?
I think the more you do, the more you learn. It's absolutely. And if you haven't got a project on the go at the moment, just play around, fiddle around. Also, listen to as much different music as you can. Get your ideas. I always used to say, take an idea and then try and create it with your equipment. Just, you know, get as much experience of creating different sounds and different landscapes as you can, and don't just sit there. If you haven't got a project to do, just say, right, I'm going to think of a beautiful day by the seaside and a walk along the beach, and I'm going to create some music. And actually, there's huge potential now for the library music. So a 3-minute track is really fun to do. And that's what I'd say to anybody starting out, is just enlarge your listening and really, you know, try and experiment as much as you can.
Amazing. Thank you so much. I really do want to stress how lucky we are to secure this interview with you, because I know in recent times you have shied away from, you know, the limelight, you know, letting some of the other composers who were at the workshop, talk a bit more about it. So I feel so lucky that we managed to secure this interview. Obviously, I have to mention that it's partly because Polly is so lucky to call you her auntie. And clearly she will have to repay you in Christmas presents for the next decade.
Rubbish.
I will.
I am so proud of what Polly is doing. So proud. And, I think it's amazing. And I mean, of course, I've loved all your songs, Katie. So, you know, I'm delighted to do it. And I'm partly delighted to do it because I'll do anything for other women. I know that sounds sexist and awful, and I'm not supposed to say that, but it's absolutely true. It was true. I think now there are loads more women, really good women or girls doing, you know, not frightened by the technology and, in the field. But I have to say that when I was doing it, there were very, very, very few. And it really was a man's world. Dreadful, actually.
Really?
Oh, very much so. The big person, the really big person, of course, was Delia Derbyshire, who was back in the 60s. There was a trio of them. I can't quite remember the chaps' names, but there were three of them or four of them. And she was, you know, she's the one who very sadly died prematurely, but was a complete character. And she rang me up 2 or 3 times not long before she died. And unfortunately, she had a drink problem, so she was totally drunk. But we were on the phone for about an hour and a half. And we both said how great it would have been if we could have worked together. Because I reckon with her imagination, my imagination, we could have really worked together well. And we could have put up a good fight, you know. I mean, when I was there at the workshop, I took over Blake 7 and other people were doing Doctor Who, and there was this sort of rivalry, and I was really made to feel that Blake 7 was, poof, you know, I don't think it was in my imagination, you know, it was sort of slightly looked down on. And there was always this sort of, I don't know, it was of its time, I think. And, I'm very glad now that everything's so much more equal now, and women have girls have just as much chance of doing music and being in the musical world as chaps.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I still think there's a balance that isn't quite equal yet. There seems to be a lot more men who do the technology degrees and stuff than the women, but I do think it's changing in the right direction for sure. I'm intrigued, these conversations that you had with Delia Derbyshire.
It was very sad. It was very sad. She just said how much she wished that we had been coincided at the workshop, because unfortunately, when I joined, they were quite sniffy about her, very sniffy about her, and say, oh, you know, and then all of a sudden she became this icon, and as she should have been. But I agree with you, the technology is the thing that holds people back. As you said earlier, I crossed a lot of, you know, I went from tape through, you know, digital through to computers, basic BBC computers, right up to state-of-the-art Apple Macs. And, you know, the engineers didn't always know exactly. I mean, I do have an amazing team now at Yellow Technology who look after everything now. But I must admit, I don't write music now. I listen to it and love it, but I don't actually write it now. I'm always out to hear something, but, you know, the technology would just kill me.
That leads me really nicely onto my next question, actually. So, I mean, I learned a lot about you and your career whilst researching this interview. You know, for me, in my youth, you were my wonderful Auntie Liz.
Yeah.
But I realised, you know...
I still am, Polly.
You still are. I know, but I mean, I feel like, my eyes have kind of been opened, because when, as I grew up and became an adult and working in music, I started to realise what an incredible career that you've had. You know, I remember going into your studio as a child, and you were actually the first person to record my voice, I think. You had this wonderful desk. It was downstairs in a basement, and it was circular.
That's right.
I remember you said that it was built so you could move around to access everything quickly. And I remember doing that while my cousins were upstairs. And so this is quite a personal question, but how did you find that balance of working in the music industry and family life? How was that for you?
Oh, Polly, it was the worst. It was the worst. I really tried to work during the day between 9 and 3. So there again, I was very, very focused. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I had to leave early. Sometimes I had to work late. But by and large, I really, really tried to separate. And because I was freedom, it was almost like being freelance, but being, you know, in the BBC, I could leave to go to sports day or any parents' evenings or anything like that. But I have to say, I felt perennial guilt. And I never quite got over it. And one or two things I turned down, quite big things that I turned down, like a couple of films, because it would have meant working right through the summer holidays. So, you know, it is a balance. And the children tease me still about, oh, we were abandoned. They jolly well weren't. But I have to say, I think it is the hardest thing, really. And in a way, it would have been much easier if I'd had a studio at home all the time, but that just wasn't how it was. When I got the job, I got it against 7 or 8 other male people. And you know what the head said? He said, oh, well, we've given you this job because you're a girl, and we thought it's good to have another girl in the outfit. You know, it was so, you know, thanks very much. I thought I'd got it on my merit. Yeah, right. Wow. But because I'd got the job, I was determined that I had to try and make it work. But it was very, very, very hard. And I don't, you know, the children certainly got looked after and everything, but it wasn't the easiest thing at all. And I couldn't have done it without some amazing help. So, yeah, it's tough. And I know that you're doing a similar kind of thing, Polly, and it's never easy, you know. It's never easy.
That's why I just think it's so essential that we do encourage women, you know, and we encourage young mothers that, you know, to create not a hostile environment at work, but actually a really welcoming one and a nurturing one.
Oh, my goodness. People need to understand that just because you're a mother, you don't suddenly lose all your creativity.
Of course.
You know, this thing of if you can share you know, share working time with your partner or have a wonderful person to help look after the children, that's fine. You know, it really does have to become more flexible. But obviously in the mid, late 70s and 80s, it just wasn't like that at all. And it was extremely, extremely hard, I think.
If you could, you know, if you were sort of in charge, if you were in charge of an institution like the BBC, what kind of principles would you set out so that it could be really inclusive?
I think people have just got to get more understanding about the fact that women are just as equal as men. And having a family shouldn't preclude you from also, you know, being a really good worker. But having said that, I do think you probably need to be freelance. I think it's very hard these days. I still think it's operated by a lot of men in suits at the top. I may be wrong, or else a lot of women who've got to the top and are quite hard. You know, they've had to be. And I don't think we're there yet in terms of equality at all. So if I were doing it all again, I would probably try and be freelance and do my work around the children. But I know it's totally changed now anyway. So I think it would be a lot easier to be freelance and employ an engineer. But don't forget that in 1977, when I joined, there was no other way of doing it. I mean, people didn't have home studios, really. That only really happened in the sort of 80s and 90s, when everyone could have the same, could get synthesizers. No. And of course, we ended up with the same synthesizer in the workshop. And it was very important not to have a homogenized sound. You know, it's very, had to use the sounds differently. But a lot of people had similar synthesizers because they became so cheap. So, but now I just wonder how I did it, really. And I mean, the children actually say that, and they're in their 30s and 40s now, and they sort of say they weren't really damaged, but they still love to tease me.
You mentioned that you have some old tapes of yours being released. Can you tell us anything about that? Is that on the horizon?
It's you're getting it hot off the press, because we actually started getting this together in 2017 with Nanny Tango, Alan Gubby, and it's sort of sat there. I think I moved it all off my computer because I thought, okay, nothing's going to happen. And then suddenly last week I got an email from him saying, right, we're Trunk want to go ahead, and he sent me all the tracks. I'm just literally going through them this morning and trying to find some photos and things like that. So I think they want to release it in next year, 2022. Uh-huh. And so all of a sudden it's a great panic. And you know, I said, hang on, I've been waiting since 2017. I'd just given up. But I guess that's the way it goes. But I'm quite pleased with it because I haven't actually listened to anything for ages. And when I listen to it, it's all sounds. It's not tunes or anything like that. Well, it couldn't be because those were all BBC stuff. So this is all stuff that I did on my own, experiments, you know, playing around with sound. So actually, in that respect, I find it quite interesting. Wow. Even I find it quite interesting.
And are these just tapes that you had in your house, or where were they found?
Well, I used to keep when I did my own stuff, I used to keep that separately. Uh-huh. And I, you know, I sort of know all my work. I've got it all on DAT, which I can't play DATs now, but it's all on my computer. So I know exactly when I was experimenting and when I, you know, sometimes I'd send something off to somebody and say, is this what you want? Yeah. Does this get the feel of it? So this is what these all are, things that weren't actually used broadcast, but things where I was sort of finding my way and thinking, yeah, is this right? There was something for a crime drama, and he said, I don't like synthesizers. I don't want any synthesizers in it. I said, oh, okay. And so I just made up a whole load of sounds, and put together a piece. And I think I had to use one synthesizer in the end. But actually, he went off the idea. I don't think I got the commission in the end.
So, wow. That sounds so beautiful, and I cannot wait to hear it.
Yeah, I'm very excited.
I know. Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining us today. I don't know where the time has flown, but I know your time is so precious. So it really has been such a gift to speak to you and to get this insight of your life and career.
Mm-hmm. it's been an absolute joy to talk about music again, because you're quite right. I've really shied away from talking about it. I love talking about it, and I love listening to music still. And it's just been an absolute joy. And you've made me think about things that I hadn't thought about for a long time.
Liz, you're an absolute inspiration. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
You know, it's been great talking to you.
Thank you so much. You've been listening to The Detail with me, Katie Mellower.
And me, Polly Scattergood. If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, it's been lovingly made by me and Katie. The editing, however, has been done by me in my studio. So if you're a fan of this podcast and you'd like to hear more, receive additional content and the odd special treat sent directly from me to you, please head on over to my Patreon page to give your support. The address is patreon.com/PollyScattergood. Thanks so much.